What we have just brewing a little underneath the surface is this huge iceberg that we can't see.
It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Wealth Architect Podcast. I'm glad you're here. And it's not often that I get to get really excited about a guest who I've been following for a long time. And I'm excited about throwing her some interesting questions because she really has a handle on what I call truth, right? And when we actually can get to the bottom of transparency and get to the real truth, that's when we can start making decisions. So when we have propaganda thrown at us, we have censorship thrown at us, we don't really get the truth. We don't get the ideas that we need to hear to be able to decide what the truth or what our own truth is. And this guest today comes to us from Phoenix, Arizona. She's the chief market analyst at ITM Trading. That's a precious metal company. She's been doing it for 25 years, and she's made it her mission to educate and empower individuals to mitigate long-term financial risk, right? Big mouthful, but the bottom line is there are ways to minimize our risk in this crazy world, and she's got some solutions. With a team of expert researchers and analysts, ITM Trading creates custom portfolio strategies for its clients, which are historically proven to protect your wealth and assets through any economic downturn or currency collapse. You might know what I'm going to be talking about with this guest. Please, let's welcome Lynette Zhang. Lynette, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's
say
it's going to
be fun.
It's going to be fun. Let's set the stage, Lynette, because you know, it doesn't really matter when we're having this conversation. The world, you couldn't have made this stuff up 5 years ago, right? We couldn't have sat there and said that we're going to have a transgender movement that's taking over, that we're going to have a Fed. Well, we might have been able to predict this 5 years ago, but the way that they're going about it, the way they lifted the sanctions, or they created the sanctions and violated the money that Russia had, you couldn't have made a lot of the stuff that's going on monetarily, economically, culturally, you couldn't have. And this world has changed so much just in the last few years. And that's where our backdrop begins. So let's find out a little bit about you. I know that you're from out west and you have some degrees and some expertise in the financial market. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be to where you are today at ITM Trading.
Well, to be honest, Mark, I feel like I have been groomed for this moment in time.
I do too.
And I actually started on, you know, with my uncle, who was a major antique dealer. So I started in this industry on a variety of levels since I was 10, and I was born in 1954. And actually, a lot of what we're seeing right now, we really also saw around the 60s and the 70s, as we were transitioning current from one currency standard, at least a quasi-gold-backed standard, to a debt-backed standard. So it's not quite as unique as we would like to think that it is. So I've been doing this, and I got into banking early and studied business finance and stayed in banking until I became a single mom. Then I became a stockbroker because I needed to earn more money. And, you know, and in that capacity, I actually stumbled across non-dollar denominated bonds, which are actually just about currencies. And that's that really began my study of currencies. And that was 1987. So I was there on Black Monday for that experience as we were lifting off to globalization. And I'm so grateful to be as old as I am so that I've seen this. I came to ITM in 2002 after my formulas confirmed that what was really happening was the end of this currency life cycle. And so there are these repeatable patterns. That's what the strategy is based upon. These patterns that happen 100% of the time. And we have well over 4,800 currencies that do not exist anymore, government-based currencies that don't exist anymore. So there's a ton of data to draw from. And even though I can't guarantee tomorrow, the reality is if something's happened the same way 100% of the time in the past, and we're doing the same thing, I think your best shot is what's going to, that we know what's going to happen. And you can get into a position to serve, not just survive this, but actually thrive through it and be in a better place on the other side of this.
Yeah.
So
if you don't study history, you're doomed to repeat it, as some brilliant person said back in the middle of the last century. And it's so true, right? And I'm a probabilities person. I think you're a probabilities person. We don't know when the dollar is going to crash and fail. And we know that it's like a train wreck. It's just happening in slow motion. But is it tomorrow? Is it next Thursday? Is it 2 years from now? Is it 20 years from now? We don't know. We know it's going to happen, right? It's like when you watch the Titanic, you know how it ends. You just, you know, there's a story in between there. And so we've got to figure out how to plug the story for ourselves to be able to figure out what's going to happen. Now let's talk about, let's go to the present now. We've just had five major bank failures, okay? The Fed and the Treasury wouldn't let them fail. They bailed them out, as they always have done and always will do until they can't do it anymore, right?
Right.
But we had five banks, including the, you know, one of the largest systemic banks in the world, and that's Credit Suisse. And Deutsche Bank is probably coming on the heels pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got several that are happening. It's just, to me, it's like the dominoes are falling, but it's like they've slowed down the video. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Will the Fed's backstopping of, you know, using the FDIC as the quasi insurer of your money. I know.
I'm sorry. It's such a joke.
It really is. But it worked. It's not a joke if everybody takes it seriously, and they do, like they buy it. So how is that going to prevent more banks from failing, or are we done? Like, is it all good now?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, actually the FDIC admittedly has $128 billion in their fund to bail out these failing banks. But yet the Fed went behind the scenes to the Treasury and borrowed $184 billion and loaned the FDIC $148 billion of that $184,000 to bail out those banks. So that nobody would know that there is no money in there. So two banks took more. Of course, we did bail out venture capitalists and technology companies, which would be instrumental in helping the Fed bring out, you know, the CBDC, the central bank digital currency.
Oh, you want to go there, huh?
I don't want to go there, but I don't know that we all, you know, I mean, we have a choice if we come together. But that, I mean, let's talk about what's happening.
Yeah.
So do I think that this is it? No. And this isn't it at all. And I think that what we have just brewing a little underneath the surface is this huge iceberg that we can't see.
Yeah.
But, you know, every quarter, just staying in the U.S. for a minute. On a quarterly basis, the office of the Comptroller of the Currency does a report on derivatives, so big leverage bets in the FDIC insured system. Now, look, Dodd-Frank was, I got to back up here just to move forward for just a second.
We're opening up all kinds of threads here. Yeah,
really. And it, you know, I mean, and okay. So in 1933, they enacted Glass-Steagall, which separated risk-taking Wall Street banks from deposit-taking banks, and also instituted that lovely FDIC to give people confidence, because this is a con game, requires confidence, but to give people confidence in the system. Well, they eliminated Glass-Steagall and allowed those two to merge. And I don't know, maybe I've missed it, but have you heard them talking about making those two entities separate again? Because I haven't heard them talk about doing that, right? So they enacted Dodd-Frank to take away this proprietary trading, this speculative trading from the banks. But they never really implemented it. If you look at that report from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, even after all of these accounting tricks to make it seem smaller, we still have a greater amount of derivatives in the system. In fact, and this blows me away, and it should, even if you don't quite understand it fully, I mean, get this concept, and then I want to hear what you think about this too. But these FDIC banks actually spent $180 trillion in accounting gimmicks to make it appear that there's $185.9 trillion in the FDIC banking system. I mean, can you even comprehend what that means?
Sure.
Right?
It makes total sense based on everything else that's going on. So, like, you know, the light bulbs are clearly going on for me.
Right? So, yeah. You know, and you have to think about this, because if they were willing to spend $180 trillion to reduce or make it appear that the size of derivatives were reduced, they saved more than that in fees, where they wouldn't have done it, right? It has to make sense monetarily. And since many of these derivatives are leveraged 1,000 to 1, how many quadrillion in these leveraged bets that you can't even convert into the underlying, how big is that, is the underneath part of that iceberg? All we've seen with these five banks are the little tip.
Yeah.
How does a central bank bail that out?
Well, there's only one way, as we know, and it's called Zimbabwe, right?
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
Hyperinflation. And, you know, when I was a kid, they, you know, my dad always said, never rely on Social Security. And We're not going to talk about Social Security right now, but he said, never rely on it. And then I started to listen to that because my dad kind of planted it in my head when I was a kid. And then I heard, oh, Social Security is going to run out of money, you know, by the year 2010. And then it was 2020, and now it's 2033. And, you know, Social Security never has run out of money. Interesting. Even though we've spent more and more money every year in deficit spending as just the United States, not even talk about the rest of the world, Social Security seems to have an unlimited amount of money. So does the FDIC. And so that whole description that you just told me about reminds me of an upside down pyramid. So they build them, instead of building the pyramids with a big, wide, strong foundation, they flip the whole thing so that the foundation is on top. It doesn't matter. And it's all resting on this little point that's being held up by these stakes. Mm-hmm. And you got this drunk guy that's coming along, and he walks and he kicks one of the stakes and the stake breaks. What do you think happens to the pyramid? That's what the derivatives thing that you just talked about reminds me of, because it's so huge that as soon as, like, the bank runs that happened a couple of weeks ago at Silicon Valley Bank, Signature, wherever, as soon as we started having people losing confidence, they came in to shore it up. It was like kicking that stake, but they got the stake back under it. It's still toppling a little bit, but the stake is there. But now the stake has got more pressure on it. Mm-hmm. And so what happens when we get another systemic, what happens when one of the big four, you know, starts to break down? Because now we're, as you know, and as you talk about, we have fewer and fewer and fewer banks that are a bigger and bigger part of these stakes that are holding up the pyramids. There are only four stakes now. Mm-hmm. And when one of them or one of the ones that feeds into them fails, now what happens? Sorry, you got me going because you said you were going to ask me. This is an interview for you, but I think
well,
it's just
no, this
nuts.
It is insane. And, you know, and really what you were also describing was Exeter's pyramid, where up on the top, you have these, what, you know, that heavy part are all of these derivatives that can easily overwhelm the system.
Sure.
And it's an opaque area. So you can't see it coming. And it only seems like things are going slow. Wasn't it Hemingway, you know, when asked, how did you go bankrupt? And he said, slowly at first and then fast.
And then all of a sudden, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Then all of a sudden, thank you. So, you know, that's really where we're at. And I mean, I don't know this for sure, but there seems to be a really good parallel going on between when JP Morgan bought Bear Stearns in March, almost to the day. I mean, I think it was within like 7 or 8 days, you know, and then years. And then nobody really saw too much, the public, I mean, did not see too much. And we were assured that everything was fine and it was contained. And then what happened in September was the public became aware when they allowed Lehman, which was my alma mater. That's where I was a stockbroker.
Right. Yeah.
Right. When they let that fail because, I don't know why they did that. Or maybe I do know why they did that. Because we assume that they're trying to keep things the same when in reality, we are at the very end of this currency's life cycle.
Hey, it's Mark Yeagy, author of this book on covered calls, here to tell you about my cash flow machine trading program that's designed to show you how I make safe, reliable income. Now, I shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income in my portfolio, and we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of it is that it only takes me about 20 minutes a week, maybe to an hour to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month may not sound like much, I show you exactly how I took my IRA from $111,000 to over $700,000 in just 23 months without huge risk. Yes, I got a little lucky, I gotta say, but I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io, or better yet, go to this link to get access to videos and masterclasses that explain the entire process, the risks and rewards even more. See you there.
Okay. As a life cycle.
So that, I mean, that's perfect for this question, because now we've gone from hundreds of systemic banks to maybe 4 or 5 systemic banks. You know the big ones, right? You know which ones we're talking about, everybody. Yeah. And so now we've got these few too big to fail banks, and it's all organized and it's probably all orchestrated from a long time ago. And now what is the future? Where does the future lead us? Where now it's 4, it was 37, 10 years ago or whatever, 5 years ago, and now it's 4. Pretty soon it's going to be what? What does it look like,
Lynette? Well, in Switzerland, it's 1.
Yeah.
Right? Now it's 1. And really, I mean, we are resetting the entire system socially, economically, and financially. And what we have going forward looks very much like the feudal system, where you just have, just this small little handful of rulers and everybody else is renting everything. I mean, what does the World Economic Forum say?
You'll own nothing and be happy.
Exactly. Well, I do think that people will own nothing because we've been trained to own nothing. But I'm pretty sure you won't be happy if somebody else is dictating. And we are transitioning into, and I hate this so much, into a full surveillance economy. Just like, I've been saying for a long time, that China is showing us how to control their population. But the hope that recently happened for me was rise in the populist, and it's not over yet, but the rise in populism in China, where you had people protesting and rioting, and they went from a zero COVID policy to a completely open policy. And that wasn't an accident. They had to do something because there is, and this is true for all of us, there are more of us than there are of them. And we vote with, in this country anyway, we vote with our wallets. So if you buy stocks, that's your vote. If you stay in fiat money, that's your vote. If you buy gold and silver, that's your vote. Or if you buy cryptocurrencies, that's your vote.
Those seem to be the only votes that count, actually.
Exactly. Well, right? Exactly. I will not support any company that will only allow me to pay with credit or debit and not cash. Now, I may choose to pay with cash. I may choose to pay with a different way, and they don't even understand why. But when you read the documents from the different central bankers and the IMF and the BIS and all these guys, what do they say? But that they need distance between their policy and how it's introduced to the public, so you don't know that it's their policy. Well, that's pretty stinky to me, right? Trying to keep that covered. And it was 2015 with the IMF report, which is probably one of my all-time favorite reports, which was breaking below the lower zero bound. So anybody, I don't have privy to any information that everybody else doesn't have privy to, but they actually talked about how to get rid of cash, how to get people to volunteer it. And they said, we need the retail public to introduce it. So I know the retail public has lots of reasons why they won't, you know, why they won't accept cash. I mean, after all, it got really dirty all of a sudden and blah, blah, blah. But it goes back to central bank policy, because when they make this transition, they need it to be as normal as possible. And they've been leading us in this direction, really. We got the first credit cards, well, the first credit to the general public in the 20s, but then the first credit card in the 50s. So they've been doing that and reducing that, because reducing people's use of cash, because after all, cash does not preserve your purchasing power. Gold and silver do that. But it does prevent central banks from going below zero. And they've already gotten all of the purchasing power out of these currencies. So they have to attack principal. And that's what negative rates are about. And once it's all digital, what do they say? These are their words, not mine. There are no limitations on how low we can push rates. Not to have negative rates. They're telling us that's a choice. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but I work awfully hard for the money that I get. So what do I want to do? Convert that into a bond. So loaning somebody money that I'm guaranteed not to even get my principal back because it's a negative rate bond. I mean, you know, who would you do that to? Maybe your children that you don't expect to get the money back from, right?
Right. All right. This has been great. We've opened up a whole bunch of stuff. So let me summarize if I can a little bit.
Please.
All right. The banking system is failing. That's the overall thing.
Oh, 100%.
Currency is failing. As we've seen when we go to buy eggs, that you don't need anything other than that example to know that the currency is failing. But if you want to know the real story behind it, you get smart people like Lynette that read the 2015 IMF report and can give you a synopsis of what it is. But banks have been consolidating power into, quote, too big to fail, unquote, systemically important institutions. The culture is shifting. Cash is going away. And Lynette mentioned something called a CBDC, which is a central bank digital currency. It means the Fed's going to print their own money. And will they get rid of the big four pillars of the banking system? Will we get rid of the Fed? Will the Fed be absorbed into the Treasury, or is it all the same anyway? And so now we're looking at there is this movement away from cash. There's a movement that you can't leave money in a bank anymore. You won't get anything as a consumer for it. And you have inflationary, you know, buying power pressure that's eroding your dollar and your euro, your yen at a daily rate. That's you just can't hold on to that money. So they're going to make you spend it now. When they put in a central bank digital currency, is that their ploy to make it so that you can't save money anymore? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And this is not my opinion. Really, all you have to do is look at the foundation. There are four key pillars of money, right? It is a tool of measure, a tool of barter, a short-term store of value so that you're ensuring you're fairly paid for your labor currently, and a long-term store of value so that no matter when you use that money, you are always fairly paid for your labor, because that's what we work for, right?
Yep.
Well, they already eliminated the third one by design through inflation, because inflation guarantees, as you said, that that you cannot buy the same amount of goods and services for your money in the future that you can today, right? But once we go into this purely digital CBDC, and they're talking about negative rates, they're eliminating that third pillar of you even being fairly paid for your labor today. because it gets immediately deposited into an account that is subject to negative rates, on which, their words, not mine, they can have their finger on the button constantly in real time. We are a consumer-driven economy. If the consumer is trying to save, that's not good for a consumer-driven economy. But if you're sitting there watching your principal disappear and you're not spending it, it's disappearing because of negative rates, then what are you more likely to do? Take that money. Exactly. Spend it. Take that money. Put it somewhere where it might have some chance of holding its value as a tool of barter.
All right. Let me stop you right there, because that's a perfect spot to stop. Now you've got the Fed with the little joystick controlling how you're going to spend your money.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about the social ramifications of how the Fed or the government, forget about the Fed, how the social ramifications might play out in a CBDC. Mm-hmm. And then I got another question after you go. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, again, if you read their documentation, this is all part of the plan where, you know, they can dictate how you spend it, where you spend it, how much of it you can spend. If you can't, how long this currency lives, right? So, you know, it sounds like there's an opportunity for social scoring to me. What do you think?
What's social scoring? I think so too, but what is it? Explain it to us.
Okay. It's really simple. Like they would probably cut me off. They would probably cut you off and say, oops, your money is no longer valid. You can't go spend it anywhere.
But why would they do that to us?
If we disagree with their policy, if we don't go along with them, and this is why it's so critical to get control of it now, for us to all come together in community and say no and buy gold, which is actually, and silver, but mostly gold, because that's the primary currency metal and it's proven for thousands of years, but it truly is outside of the system. So they want you in the system because then they can control your behavior. It was back in the early 80s with President Reagan who brought over Rupert Murdoch and changed the rules so that he could come over and create what's called perception management. This takes that to a whole new level. But perception management is about controlling how you think about things. So therefore, controlling how you move forward. Like a great example is price stability. Now, don't you hear them talk about the need for price stability all the time?
Yeah.
Now, what do you and I, the normal person, would assume that price stability means prices don't change, right? Wouldn't that be your assumption?
That would be, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's not what price stability is. Price stability is a low enough level of inflation so that you, the individual, don't ask for more pay because you're not trying to combat the inflation. So if they can keep it at 2%, then, hey, you don't ask for more money and they get to rob you. You're actually volunteering, because even when you get those raises do not keep pace with inflation. And so your standard of living actually declines. You take on more debt to try and maintain it. Gosh, in 1971, the average wage was like $9,500, and a family of four could live with one wage earner.
That's right.
Today, it's like $57,000, something like that. And you need two wage earners. And what did they stimulate? Under $150,000, which I remember. My father was a developer. And I remember this. I don't know why, you know, but I used to babysit for this family. And he was an engineer at IBM. And I remember, and my parents used to work out of the house. So I remember they left and my mother pounding her fist on the table and saying, he's a comer. He's a comer. He makes $12,000 a year.
You need to marry that guy.
Well, he was already married with babies, okay. And I babysat for him for 50 cents an hour.
But that type of guy. Yeah, right.
That type of guy. Right. So, you know, I mean, back then that was substantially more than the average wage earner. And my father built a nice house. So
$12,000 a year as a single wage earner, which covered a whole family. And today it's $57,000. That's a devaluation of what, 500% of the buying power of just in 50 years?
Oh, yeah.
That's 100% a year.
It's by design. And here's the scary part. They put all of this system in place because they knew not one man in a million understood inflation. And didn't we just have those leaders, Jay Powell, Yellen, and also Lagarde, Christine Lagarde, come out and say they don't understand inflation.
I know. I love it.
That's a problem.
I love it. Well, we got a 69-year-old attorney. Not that there's anything wrong with attorneys, but he's the most powerful man in the world because he controls the world's money, essentially. He's making decisions. Not that an economist would do any better with this, it's not even Keynesian. It's beyond Keynesian. It's this MMT nuttiness, you know, trying to handle our money. Okay. So this is great. Are you guys getting this? Are you getting this, everybody? Because this is the stuff that's going on. And we don't, if you're not educated, it's happening so quickly behind the scenes that you're not even noticing it. You might say, oh, my eggs are a little bit higher price and it costs me a little bit more to buy gas, but I'll worry about that later. But you're not getting the raises if you're a 9-to-5er. You're spending more money. You're being told what to think and do. Are you getting this? This is what's going on in the world. And it's not just in this country. It's you know, worse and happening in other countries as well. By the way, the suffix on that CBDC thing is if you don't have a good social credit score in China, you can't get in to buy groceries. If you've taken too many flights and burned up too many, created too many carbon dioxide molecules in the air, they limit your travel, things like that. It's already being done in China. Right. We're just not talking about it, except on this program and when wherever else you get your dose of Lynette, which I hope is a lot. And so that's where a lot of this is going. So I want to introduce another concept in here because I know you're a gold and silver person. And my dad was a big silver person. He collected silver so he could give it to us when he died and all those kinds of things. And silver continues to be undervalued compared to the way gold has gone, I think. You can tell me if I'm correct on that. But I believe that there's another layer that we should also expose ourselves to, because you said something important earlier. That's you've got to get yourself outside the system. Now, I'm getting ready to go to Greece again. And in Greece in 2013, by the way, pay attention to this, everybody. Yep. In 2013, you couldn't get more than $400 a month out of your bank account. They put capital controls in there. If worse yet, if you were in Cyprus, and I have a friend that did this, she put $100,000 into the bank in Cyprus thinking it was safe. It wasn't so damn safe, because what they did is they came and took her money and said, don't worry, we're going to give you $30,000, which you can't pull out for years. And we'll give you 70,000, it's euros, not dollars, but we give you 70,000 euros in stock in this worthless bank that just went out of business. So they just haircutted her by 70%. And at the same time, they put capital controls so you couldn't go out and spend money. Okay. And then what they did is they had a government that came in and said, well, we need to pay for all the spending that we're doing, because people that are hairdressers can retire at 59. And so they created, by putting a 24% VAT, a value-added tax on everything, they created a black market economy. And so now if you go to Greece, you get the cash price of something and you get the receipt price of something. So if you go and you have six people at a restaurant, I got fired up here just talking to you. Thank you. Got some good energy. But if you go to a restaurant, you have six people and you all eat and it's, you know, $200, you go to the restaurant owner back, you go, listen, how about we do this without the receipt? He doesn't have to pay the government the 24%, and he doesn't have to pay tax on the cash that you just paid him. So the whole thing becomes outside the system. So the government screwed themselves by raising taxes. That's a model for what's going to happen. And when you say outside the system, that's where I see outside the system. So I want to introduce, that's the backdrop for Bitcoin, right? Not crypto, but Bitcoin. To me, Bitcoin is the only scarce one. It's decentralized. There's not a human sitting on it like Jay Powell that's putting his finger on the spending. It's outside the system. Is there a role for Bitcoin in the future, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say that Bitcoin, you know, I mean, I've been watching Bitcoin since it was $7. All right. So I've been watching it for a long time.
Me too.
And I know that in the Bank for International Settlements money flower, there is a very small petal that enables or allows or has room for some kind of private cryptocurrencies. Whether or not that will be Bitcoin, I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I see a lot of adoption from Wall Street, which makes me uncomfortable. Right.
Okay.
I mean, you know, so I, at this moment, I own no cryptocurrencies, no Bitcoin, none of that. That's not, I don't imagine that's going to be true into the future. But, you know, I read the NSA 1996 white paper on how to create a mint and seemed to be an awful lot of similarities between that white paper and Bitcoin. And I was also there in January. Now, I didn't see it just as it came out, but Bitcoin came out in January of 2009.
Yes.
And QE started in March, of 2009. So for me, that seems awfully coincidental.
Let me throw another piece of conspiratorial information in there. Bitcoin was created by a guy or a person or a group called Satoshi Nakamoto. And this, it was supposedly this brilliant cryptographer that took all the cryptocurrency inventions of the past and combined them into this incredible system. And then in 2011, I think, maybe 10 or 11, to completely disappeared and left behind not only Bitcoin, but left behind 1 million Bitcoin, which are called the Genesis block. Right. And I think if you do the numbers on it, it's like $280 billion worth of Bitcoin that is, or $28 billion anyway. And if Bitcoin continues to go up, that's going to be worth a lot. And is it ever going to be cashed in? And there are some people that say that's the government that created that.
Well, okay. And let me kind of throw this out, Mark.
Yeah.
Because when you're quoting those numbers, what are they in terms of?
Well, they're in terms
that
of
have
dollars.
No value?
They're okay. In terms of dollars, right.
So
the denominator.
So, exactly. And so I have a little bit of a challenge with that because people get blinded by numbers. That's why it's important for the stock market to go up or cryptocurrencies to go, or whatever it is, right? And why it's also important to suppress the visible price of gold through the spot market, because there's an unlimited amount of that. But last time I checked, a trillion times zero was still zero. And here's where I have a challenge. What is, besides being able to put your Bitcoin on a little zip drive and put it in your pocket and take it wherever you go, which I think is a very important function, other than that, what's its functionality and what other areas besides the financial area can this be used in? Because that's where I have my hiccup.
What specifically are you referring to? What other areas can it be used in? You mean other geographical areas? What do you mean?
Well, no, not geographical, but economic. Like, for example, gold is used in every single area of the global economy. So it's used in the financial system, but it's also used in electronics. It's used in medicine. It's used in space travel. It's used in food. It's used in art. It's used in jewelry, right? So you have the broadest base of functionality and the broadest base of buyer. That's why it's never gone to zero, right? Because they still haven't been able to figure out the qualities of gold and duplicate that in a lab, right? So when I'm asking what other areas can Bitcoin be used in, it's the same thing with the dollars. It's only used in the financial area. That's it. So you're going into a fight. You're going into a war. What do you want? You want a little pocket knife? Or do you want a big bazooka and cannons and everything else? That's nice. The difference for me between gold and Bitcoin.
Yeah. I love it. I'm not going to be able to orange pill you in the remaining time that we have together. But if I had another hour, I could probably orange pill you. And orange pilling means that I convert somebody to Bitcoin, but that's okay.
You know what? I would love it if you would try. Many have tried.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, and I have to tell you, Mark, I am open.
Yeah, I know.
You're just going to have to show me that piece.
Listen, I'll just say a couple things just because we've opened the Pandora's box on Bitcoin. I think, and I love metals, right? I love platinum, gold, silver. I think there's a case for them. But in this world, as we've already set that stage earlier in this call, in this world, and gold is not immune from this, things can be confiscated. If you have gold, mm-hmm. Back in 1935, I want to say, they made it illegal to own gold. It was a felony if you had gold. Mm-hmm. You had to turn your gold in at a predetermined price to the government, or you could be thrown in jail. Now, that could happen to Bitcoin, but Bitcoin, you can move in 2 seconds. And by the way, you can move Bitcoin into gold and out of gold if you want.
Maybe.
I look at Bitcoin a little bit differently. Most people are like, well, yeah, but it's, it's, you can't spend it. It's hard to use around the world. I look at it a couple of ways. First of all, it's not from our paradigm in our banking system that it has the most benefit. It is in the paradigm of the people in Nigeria that don't have access to a bank, that now they can take their phone and with a $50 phone, they can have access to a bank right in their pocket and they can move money at the speed of light for a very little cost. You can't do that on a Saturday afternoon if you want to send money across the world. You can't do it with gold either. So to me, Bitcoin, and we can kind of tie this up in a second here, but Bitcoin is kind of like digital gold. But I look at Bitcoin not even as a money right now. I look at it as an insurance policy. Okay. To me, it's a place that you can, if you were in Afghanistan and you had your money in the banking system last year when we left, you lost all of your money. If you were one of the wealthy people that were able to get it out into Bitcoin, you walked across the border, not having to carry a suitcase full of gold, which would have been confiscated, but having to remember a 12 or a 24 word phrase. And that means you can just go reproduce and collect your Bitcoin back in Poland. So there are some of those geographical benefits. The fact that 70% of the world is unbanked, the fact that it is electronic, in my opinion, it's digital gold. So it sits alongside of gold to me. I don't think it eliminates gold. I don't think it eliminates a dollar. I think all of these things have a place to play, a role to play. But I think it is insurance against this craziness that we have. And in 14 years, it's never been hacked. It's never been violated. And it's certainly not run by one decentralized 69-year-old lawyer. So that's what I got to say about that for now.
Okay. So I got to say something more too.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Okay. Number one, there is just like there are all different kinds of cryptocurrencies and you're honing in on Bitcoin. And I do, that's what I said. The functionality of being able to move it on a little thumb drive is that's the best part of it for me.
Yes.
But let's go to confiscation for a second.
Sure.
Because my Uncle Al showed me in 1964, my parents and I were at his house and he goes, come here, I want to show you something. And he took us in a back bedroom where there were two tall floor safes. Now you're right. You couldn't legally own more than 5 ounces of gold in 1964, except for the way that he had them. Because in those two tall floor safes, when he opened the door, you couldn't fit one more gold coin in there. But since he was a major antique dealer, he'd go into these high-end homes and he was probably buying the coins for spot, but they were all pre-1933, which were exempt from confiscation. So personally, I do not, and this has not always been true. There was a time when I did own bullion, but I do not own bullion at all because I do think that there will indeed be another confiscation. So I own it in the way that is least likely to get confiscated, which are the collectibles, because some of those coins are going for $15 million for 1 ounce of gold. Now, if they do a confiscation, this is what I think it's most likely to look like, because they want your cooperation. So they say to you, okay, spot's at a manipulated $2,000 an ounce, and we're going to pay you $3,000 to turn it in, and they'll do a big sweep of IRAs because that's where most of the gold is held anyway. And then after they get it, just like they did in 33, then they do that revaluation because it is the currency against gold. That's how those overnight revaluations, they take something that has no intrinsic value, so in this country, dollars, and they revalue it against something that is all intrinsic value, which is gold, because of its many uses. So I can buy those collectible coins well below the true fundamental value of an ounce of gold, which is somewhere north of $15,000 right now. And I am covered whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong.
As long as the legislation doesn't say, doesn't matter if it's got numismatic or collectible value.
Okay, who do you think owns that $15 million 1 ounce gold coin? Most likely either somebody that writes the laws, like Treasury Secretary Wooten did in 33, or somebody that has the ability to influence those. Because somebody that paid $15 million for a coin is not turning it in for $3,000.
I like it.
Not going to happen.
Nope.
So it's my insurance policy, right? And I'm not even saying that you shouldn't buy Bitcoin or hold it. I'm saying diversification is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, right.
Right?
I love it. Good stuff.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go through one last concept and then we'll wrap it up because you and I could probably talk for like 6 hours and not run out of stuff to say.
I think we could. And unfortunately, I have something else coming up, but we have to do this again.
We should. We definitely should. So the last question is this, and maybe not the last question, but last concept is, are the central banks around the world accumulating gold? In other words, one of the rumors is that the U.S. doesn't have any gold in Fort Knox. And the other one is, you know, we've got plenty of gold in case we need to back up our new currency. What do you think? Are, you know, I know Russia and China, are they collecting gold or are central banks collecting it and why?
Global central banks are collecting, they have been accumulating more gold in 2022 in the first quarter going, probably, well, we'll see what the first quarter is, but more gold in 2022 than they have since 1967, which is when we were transitioning from a quasi-gold standard to a debt standard.
Right.
So yes, they are. Does the U.S. have any gold? Well, I don't know. If you look at the books, then, you know, it seems like we haven't changed even by a steenth of an ounce since, well, I think 1952.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of interesting. But the reason why central banks in general are accumulating gold is because they know what they're doing to the currencies. They know that the current currency system is, it's dead. It died in 2008 and it's been on life support since then, but we are at the end of the ability to kick the can down the road.
So what's next then?
Well, if they have their druthers, it's CBDCs.
So and a Euro CBDC, a U.S. fiat CBDC,
yes, yen CBDC. And then we'll probably, you know, we've heard about the digital dollar. I mean, there are tests that are being run. Yeah. I don't know if they're ready or not, but unfortunately, in order to get full adoption, because they already have the FedNow account. So if you're if you're a U.S. citizen, you already have an account, whether you realize it or not. Right. Easy for them to just inject it. So unfortunately, we need a huge crisis in order to get people scared enough to go along. And so that's pretty much it. I'm sorry. I'm just getting notice here.
Okay. Listen, Lynette, thank you so much. You are an absolute pleasure and a lot of fun to talk to. And I just loved it. And I hope you guys loved it listening to this. But where can people find out more about what you do, what services you provide, those kinds of things? How can people get more Lynette Zhang?
Well, I'm pretty active on YouTube.
Yeah.
And also Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And we do podcasts constantly. So we have a number of different channels. ITM Trading is where I talk about the economy. And my goal is to translate financial noise into understandable language. So that's what I try and do and teach people how to recognize the patterns, these repeatable patterns. If you can recognize them, even if you don't understand what's happening, you can understand that things are shifting. So I'm pretty accessible and I'm all over the place.
You are all over the place, but you know what? You are a wealth of knowledge. And I want to thank you for taking the time for the Wealth Architect podcast listeners and viewers. And thanks for your time and wisdom today. I appreciate it.
Oh, this has been fun, Mark. I hope you have me back.
I can't wait. I can't wait. And those of you that are watching and listening, thanks for tuning into the Wealth Architect podcast. Remember what I always say, never give up your power in your health, your wealth, or your time. Have a great day, everybody. See you next time.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.